I, Satyajit Singh Sengarpriy, going to record the character sketch of the Sons and Lovers. First one, Walter Morel. Character sketch of Walter Morel. Introduction. Walter Morel, the miner, belongs to that class of common people who are devoid of intellectual content, full of physical life, closely in touch with the earth and rejoice in the life of nature. In his simplicity and humble acceptance of life, he is spiritually akin to the rustics of Hardy. Though the disease of the flesh has not touched him, he is open and spontaneous in his responses to life, close to the primitive in his uninhibited delight in singing and dancing and drinking. His tragedy is that he has married a woman of a middle-class family who loves ideas and books drawn upon his instinctive physical life. His fascinating youth. In his youth, Walter Morel had been a vital man of action, senses, non-intellectual, and living for the moment. He possessed a fascinating personality that cast a spell on Gertrude Morel when she met him at Christmas party. His full fine presence makes its impact felt on all who come in contact with him. He has a sturdy physique, ruddy cheeks, shiny black moustache and tumbling hair. His movements are full of animation and betoken his zest for life. Mrs. Morel feels a certain subtle exultation like glamour in his movements. It is the flame of life leaping up in him. The essential simplicity of his personality is also reflected in his rich, ringing laugh. To one meeting him for the first time, he gives the impression that there is nothing wrong about life, no complexity, and that one has only to turn to life to feel its manifold joys. Therefore, when Gertrude sees this man at the Christmas party, she is at once aware of the fact that he is a different kind of person, a sort of person she has never known before. His soft, non-intellectual, warm life both attracts and baffles her. The dusky golden softness of this man's senses, flame of life, that flowed off his flesh like the flame from a candle, not baffled and gripped into incandescence by thought and spirit, as her life was, seemed to her something wonderful beyond her. His sense of humor gives a sparkle to his first conversation with Gertrude, when she says, "You do not look as if you had come much uncurled." Walter Morel is quick in his retort. "I am like a pig's tail. I curl because I can help it. And a miner coming out from the pit at night is like a Mouldiwarp. And there is some chaps as does go round like Mouldiwarps. And if he loses some of his humor as the novel progress, it only shows to what extent his simple self has been damaged by his unfortunate marriage. His unhappy married life. Walter Morel's marriage with Gertrude had been the unfortunate result of the romantic heat of the moment. Their natures are poles apart. Since they have never been on good terms with each other, it is indeed a stroke of luck that Morel marries a woman who is so much his opposite and who will deny his personality and his way of life. Their days of happiness are short-lived. Morel hides his real condition from his wife. He manages to get furniture and other things on credit and pays rent for the house he lives in. But he never tells this to his wife and tries to liquidate his debts without her knowing it. But one day Mrs. Morel happens to discover the unpaid bills and also finds out the truth that the house they live in does not belong to Morel. This small incident shakes her faith in him. Their romantic attraction for each other begins to melt away. Mrs. Morel begins to despise him. From now, he begins to deteriorate. Lawrence has given the pitiable accounts of Morel's unhappy married life. The pity was, she was too much his opposite. She could not be content with the little he might be. She would have him the much that he caught to be. So in seeking to make him nobler than he could be, she destroyed him. his deterioration and isolation. Mrs. Morrell's unsympathetic attitude towards Mrs. Morrell has been responsible, to a great extent, for his alienation from the rest of the family. True, he has acted in an irresponsible manner, but his offense is not so great as to cool Mrs. Morrell's tender feeling for him forever. Although we see the story entirely from Mrs. Morrell's point of view, it seems that Walter Morrell is in fact being harshly treated by his wife. There is some sympathy for him, but Lawrence is biased in favor of Mrs. Morrell. From them on, Mr. Morrell is generally seen in a bad light, although there are moments when the old cheerful Morrell emerges. In fact, he resents his wife's attempt to reform him, for he loves and likes this sort of life and sees nothing vital in an intellectuality-oriented approach to life. And in trying to reform him, his wife destroys him. Hollow within, empty of values, Walter Morrell has nothing to fall back upon when once the kind of life he leads is rejected and scorned. He reacts violently to the unfeeling behavior of his wife. His manners become increasingly gross, and he meets his wife's sarcasm with offensive vulgarity. When Gertrude is discussing religion and philosophy with the minister, apparently to slight the minor who cannot participate in their highly intellectual discussion, he gives one of the most ugly exhibitions of his vulgarity. He invites the minister to look at his dirty hands and asks him to examine his singlet smelling of sweat. And when Mrs. Morrell protests against his clumsiness and tells him that the minister does not want to feel his nasty singlet, he says no, perhaps he does not, but it's all come out whether or not, and in the day like my singlet's ringing wet. All that the miner is trying to do by exhibiting his vulgarity is to make his wife realize that he works hard all the day to earn his bread, and that it does not cost much labor to sit easily in the house discussing religion and philosophy, and to think oneself superior for having had a discussion. He is also protesting against her neglect of him. And soon, Walter is left a lonely, disappointed person, having nothing to live for. Once feel pity for him when he is discarded by his wife and disowned by his own children. His loneliness amidst the crowd of people grounds him, left a derelict. Morrell made the meal alone, brutally. He ate and drank more noisily than he had needed. No one spoke to him. The family life withdrew, shrank away, and became hushed as he entered. His soul reaches out for his wife, but finds her gone. He felt a sort of emptiness, almost like a vacuum in his soul. He was unsettled and restless. His attitude towards his children. Walter Morrell is not altogether an unkind father. He is a kind and tender towards his children when he is in a good mood, but such occasions are rare. Generally, his relations with his children are marked by bitterness. He is treated by them as a person to be feared and despised rather than loved. Walter Morrell feels that he is being wronged, but he is himself responsible for the miserable situation he finds himself in. But Mrs. Morrell is no less responsible. Her too much occupation with her children makes Walter jealous. He is jealous of William, for the boy has become the center of her attention and occupies that place in her affections which he himself had occupied before his birth. And out of jealousy, he clips off young child's lock, which the mother so much loves and admires. It naturally makes Mrs. Morrell angry. But she knew, and Morrell knew too, that act had caused something momentous to take place in her soul. She remembered the scene all of her life as one in which she had suffered the most intensely. But for the most of the time, the children are afraid of him, and his brutality gets on their nerves. In Since Most Passionately Conceived and Written, the novelist describes how the poor children lie nervously in their beds, all the time fearing as to what the drunken father is going to do next. The family is hushed into silence as soon as his footsteps are heard. The six of the S3 powerfully symbolize the dreadful atmosphere of the house. The children lay silent in suspense, waiting for a lull in the wind to hear that either father was doing. He might hit their mother again, There was a feeling of horror, a kind of bristling in the darkness, and a sense of blood. They lay with their hearts in the grip of an intense anguish. Sometimes in the evening, Morel would ask his children to help him in cobbling his boots or in mending his pit bottle, and then the family is happy, for Morel is most happy when he is actively engaged in some work. On occasion, the father will regale the children by telling them stories in his own interesting way. On such occasion, the human side of his character is sharply brought into relief. His native goodness. Walter Morel may not be seen as good husband and good father, but he is not totally devoid of native goodness. He may be crude and unrefined in his manners, but he is essentially noble at heart. His repentance after he had shut his wife out on a moonlit night, or when he has hurt her by the drawer he has flung, is quite genuine. He has real love for his children, though they never respond to his feelings. As being under the influence of their mother, there are moments when Walter Morel is seen to show his real feelings for his sons. Long after William's death, he finds it unbearable to pass by the cemetery in which he is buried or by the office where he worked. Likewise, during Paul's illness, he is worried about him and visits his bedroom to inquire after his health. But Paul is quite indifferent to him. Morel also feels greatly concerned at illness of Mrs. Morel and her consequent death. A good workman and miner. Walter Morel is a good workman and miner. He is adept in doing odd tasks with his hand. The most peaceful and happy moments of his life are those when he is engaged in some such work as cobbling the shoes or mending the pit bottle. He is a good miner also, but on account of his grumbling nature, he has not been able to get any rise in his wages from his immediate boss. Morel's goodness as a workman is eclipsed by his crude manners and bad habits. His use of dialect. He speaks the dialect, and dialect in Lawrence is associated with persons full of vitality. Gertrude is pleasantly surprised when Morel thawed and thawed her. Physical tenderness is all too empowerment in his dialect. In one of his quarrels with his wife, he, out of sheer anger, flung the drawer at her and she is badly hurt near the eye. But presently his anger melts into tenderness, and in words instinct with his concern and tenderness, he asks, "Did it catch thee? Le me, look at it, lass. What has it done by thee, glass? The lass." In her perceptive eye, essay on sons and lovers, Dorothy Van Ghent points out that Paul, who normally speaks pure English like his mother, also reverts to the dialect of his father when he is tussling with Beatrice in adolescent erotic play, and that Arthur, the only child who escapes the corrupting influence of Mrs. Morel, also uses the same dialect in his lovemaking. In Lady Chatterley's Lover, the gamekeeper, Melorals, also speaks the dialect, and in that novel he stands for an organic and integrated life. Perhaps the only time when Walter Morel cuts out the dialect is when he is being introduced to Miss Lily Western, the sweetheart of his eldest son. Conclusion. Walter Morel is a natural character in Sons and Lovers. He is a type of primitive man who is instinctive and unsophisticated. Morel appears to be one of Hardy's rustics who are seen to be thrown into a brutalized conflict with the city breeds and their new ideas. Such characters are indifferent to the idiosyncrasies of culture and idealism. Thus, Morel is an unspoiled primitive. Towards the end of the novel, Morel is seen as a broken, dejected person, virtually infest and completely ignored by his family. Nobody seems to want him, nobody loves him, he no longer rules the house, and when his wife dies, he does not betray any emotions. It was as if nothing had happened. His physical courage also fails him. He is afraid to sit up through the night with the dead body of his wife. In the morning, he is afraid of going to her room. He just does not have the courage to face her. And when Annie asks him, he has seen the mother for the last time, he lies unashamedly. After the funeral, he weeps before the relatives of Mrs. Morel, but one is doubtful of the sincerity of his grief. He proclaims without slightest hesitation that he had always tried everything for her, that she had been such a good wife, and that he could never find any fault with her. It is here that Morel loses our sympathy. We wonder if a man so assertive and fearless as Morel is can think so low. Second characters. Mrs. Gertrude Morel characteristics. Introduction. Mr. Gertrude Morel occupies the place of central attraction in the novel. Her character has excited considerable interest among the critics. We are introduced to Gertrude Morel when she has been married for 8 years. She appears tired and depressed all through this novel. Her attitude towards her son and her husband, Mr. Morel, is apparent. She is awfully tied to the house and is very much a housewife and mother. The novel deals with her disillusionment in marriage, the gradual rejection of her husband, Mr. Morel, the taking on of her sons, first of William and then of Paul, as her lovers, and the disastrous effects of this unnatural but unbreakable bond on their emotional life. Her marriage with Mr. Morel has been the result of youthful romantic excitement. Mrs. Morel had been a woman of romantic nature. When she was 19, she was courted by one John Field, who later rejected her. Later, when she was 23, she met Mr. Morel at a Christmas party. She was fascinated by the charming personality of Mr. Morel and his rich fund of soft, non-intellectual, warm humor, and in particular his use of the dialect. In Lawrence's words, the dusky golden softness of this man's senses, flame of life, that flowed off his flesh like the flame from a candle. Not baffled and gripped into incandescence by thought and spirit as her life was, seemed to her something wonderful beyond her. Paul also, while speaking to Miriam, refers to his mother's attraction towards his father. He said, "Yes, but my mother, I believe, got real joy and satisfaction out of my father at first. I believe she had a passion for him. That's why she stayed with him. After all, they were bound to each other." Her predicament after marriage. We are introduced to Mrs. Morel when she has been married for 8 years. She is tired and depressed, and we are soon made to understand her attitude and relationship with her husband. Her romantic dreams of marital life are shattered, and she is wretched and depressed, especially as her husband drinks heavily. To her, his profession is ugly and undignified, his manners uncouth and gross, his life purely sensuous and therefore hateful to her. His lack of interest in things intellectual repels her. She loves ideas herself, discusses religion and philosophy with the clergyman, and hopes to be admired as an intellectual person. Besides her hatred for her husband, Mrs. Morel abhors the place so much that she thinks it to be her cross. She exhibits her intense hatred for the mining village of Bestwood. She wants to get out from there to keep her children out of the dirty profession of a miner, and does not condescend to mix with the uneducated women of the place. She rebels against life, but her rebellion is futile. Thus, Mrs. Morel's life after marriage becomes a tale of sufferings and disappointments. Her hollow middle-class values. Mrs. Morel comes of an old middle-class family of Coppards. She has inherited a typical proud, unyielding temper, a fierce variety of Puritanism, and other typical middle-class values. She also possesses a typical vanity and snobbishness. In fact, her values are hollow. She thinks herself superior to other women because she lives in an end house for which she pays a little more money than her neighbor do. She fails to see any vitality in the instinctive life of Morel and strives hard to reform him. She forbids her children from speaking the dialect of the father. unable to reform the minor, she deliberately hurts him by discussing philosophy and religion in his presence, subjects in which the uneducated, unsophisticated husband cannot participate. Her desire to prove herself intellectually superior to her husband, to prove herself a woman of refined taste and finer sensibility, wrecks her married life. She could not be content with the little he might be. She should have him the much that he ought to be. So in seeking to make him nobler than he could be, she destroys him. Her ill attitude towards her husband. Mrs. Morel has what Weavers calls an unusual capacity to nurse a slight injury, and a powerful capacity for resentment. She never forgives Morel for clipping off William's locks. This act of masculine clumsiness was the spear through the side of her love for Morel. Now she ceased to fret for his love. He was an outsider to her. She is furious to see the locks lying on a newspaper spread on the floor. No doubt Morel did this to provoke her, but should she sell so strongly about it as to cry out, "I could kill you, I could"? It is her pride, her naughty temperament, her capacity to nurse a slight that never allowed her to make it up with Morel. On the contrary, with each day, her words become sharper than ever. Shall we refer our readers to scene from the first chapter? One day Walter Morel returns from home after a very hard day's work and asks his wife if there is anything to eat in the house. In her characteristic manner, Mrs. Morel replies, "You know what there is in the house," she said so coldly it sounded impersonal. He stood and glared at her without moving a muscle. "I asked a civil question and I expect a civil answer," he said affectedly. And when Walter pulls out the drawer in anger and the things fall down on the floor with a noise that awakens the young baby, Mrs. Morel addressed her husband in a language which no man can ever understand. "What are you doing, clumsy, drunken fool?" the mother cried. And when Walter says to her that she should wait on him, she returns this answer, "Never, my lord, I had wait on a dog at the door first." Walter Morel may be crude and gross, but he is not so soulless as his wife is. Her bickering, her constant nagging destroys Morel. Unable to find any satisfaction and peace at home, and in the most unenviable position of being an outsider in his own house, he takes to drinking. His personality shrinks and he is reduced to the position of a shadowy householder who emerges from the mines only to disappear into the bars. He concerns for her children. Mrs. Morel is a possessive mother. Unable to find any satisfaction in her relations with Mr. Morel, she casts him off as her husband and turns to her sons for love and fulfillment. Being ambitious, Mrs. Morel wants her sons to rise high in life, to get away from the dirty and ugly life of bastard. It is she who urges them on in life, guiding their steps, encouraging them at every turn, kindling in them a desire for a refined and better life. She is responsible for their education and sees to it that they are not forced to go down the spit. She is a devoted mother in so far as she takes all care to provide a better atmosphere to her children, does all her household chores, and is always an access to make the children comfortable. When Paul falls ill, she nurses him back to health with unfailing care and devotion. She feels miserable to behold Paul fighting for his life and her broken sobs. "Oh, my son," convey the intensity of her love for him. Her role in destroying the emotional life of her sons. Mrs. Morel centers all her hopes on her sons after being disappointed from the side of Mr. Morel. "I have never had a husband, not really." That is how she looks at her life. She sees the fulfillment of her hopes in a growing son, first in Williams, then in Paul. They are, in fact, husband substitutes. They fill the emotional void created by the insensitive behavior of Morel. She draws her sons to her side in her fight against her drunken husband. The sons, too, are emotionally responsive to their mother. Our first glimpse of William shows him as a boy, proudly conducting his mother round the fairground. All the time he stuck close to her, bristling with a small boy's pride of her. William is deeply attached to his mother, but his departure for London is a bitter blow for Mrs. Morel. As the days draw near for his departure, her heart began to close and grow dreary with despair. She loved him so much, more than that she hoped in him so much. Almost she lived for him. She felt almost as if he were going as well out of her heart. William's death is a tragic blow to Mrs. Morel's hopes, and for a while she loses the will to live, but her attention now shifts to Paul, whose illness greatly worries her. Her whole life will now be centered on Paul, and their relationship forms the major interest in the rest of the novel. The tragedy is that she loves them so much that her life gets deeply rooted in them, first in William and then in Paul, and she cannot suffer them to be independent of her and to turn to other women for fulfillment. It is her possessive love that frustrates William's desire to achieve an adequate relationship with Lily and Paul's love for Miriam. Unable to give spiritual love to any other woman, William involves himself in a hopeless love affair with Lily based solely on sexual infatuations, but even this infuriates Mrs. Morel. She does not hide her contempt of Lily and advises William against marrying her. Nothing, she says, is as bad as a marriage that's hopeless failure. And what shall we say of the behavior of William, who, having brought his sweetheart home, scorns and insults her before her mother? Obviously, he wants to assure his mother that Lily is not spiritually on the same level as his mother and that she cannot hold his soul. It is only sexual satisfaction that he is seeking in his relation with Lily. The result is that the poor boy is torn between his desire for passion and his struggle for his mother, whom he cannot afford to hurt or displease. He fails to resolve his dilemma, and shattered and disintegrated, he dies of pneumonia in London. One cannot help feeling that his death could have been averted had Mrs. Morel freed him to seek a new life with his sweetheart. And Paul, too, is made to face the same dilemma. After the death of William, Mrs. Morel turns to him for love and fulfillment. Her life becomes rooted in him, and her hold on the boy is so strong that he fails to establish a satisfactory relationship with the other woman till she is alive. She wants to hold his life, soul, his thoughts and his affection. She is actively hostile to Miriam, for she fears that her love might drop Paul out of her range. She hurts Paul with words well calculated to touch him and alienate him from Miriam. Yes, I know it will. I am old, and therefore I may stand aside. I have nothing more to do with you. You only want me to wait on you. The rest is for Miriam. And Paul gives her the assurance she is so badly seeking. No, mother, I really don't love her. I talk to her, but I want to come home to you. And Mrs. Morel replies, I cannot bear it. I could let another woman, but not her. She had leave me no room, not a bit of room. And so is Mrs. Morel, who drives Paul to flippant girl like Clara, who can offer only physical passion. Thus, Mrs. Morel is responsible for the emotional wreckage of her sons. In fact, she has failed to realize polarity in her relations with her sons. Lawrence believed that perfect love is based on the principle of polarity. In other words, a perfect relationship is one in which one recognizes and respects the otherness of others. Any attempt by one to destroy the personality of the other would lead to disharmony and disintegration in sons and lovers. Mrs. Morel is guilty of the sin of destroying the personalities of her husband and of her sons. She refuses to recognize the otherness of Morel, of William, of Paul, and in doing so she scares her own feelings and theirs too. Her pathetic end. Mrs. Morel's end is highly pathetic. She has all the time been laboring hard to keep the family going and does not let anyone know of the fatal disease that is slowly eating into her vitals. Towards the end of the novel, she falls ill with cancer. Now Paul realizes the danger and arranges the best possible medical attention for her. But now it is too late. She clings desperately to life, even when it is apparent that she cannot outlive the fatal disease. Her intense suffering and misery get on Paul's nerves. Unable to bear the sight of her suffering helplessly, he gives her an overdose of morphia to hasten her end. At the end of the novel, one is left with the same question which troubles Paul. She has died. What was it all for? Her struggle? Now, characteristics of Paul Morel. Introduction. Paul Morel is one of the most interesting characters of D.H. Lawrence. Mrs. Morel is the dominant character in the novel Sons and Lovers, but Paul should certainly be described as the hero of the novel because so much of his experience is vividly described. It is his relations with his mother and with the other two women that is the chief attraction of the novel. His birth and personality. Paul is the third child of Gertrude and Walter Morel. The circumstances attending his birth are hardly such as would be conducive to a healthy and natural development of the child. The marriage of his parents has degenerated into an unending series of bitter quarrels, and when the third child, Paul, arrives, the mother feels herself guilty in bringing an unwanted child into a world which is barren of love. She feels wretched with the coming child. She could not afford to have this third. She did not want it. The father was serving beer in public house, feeling himself drunk. She despised him and was tied to him. This coming child was too much for her. She was sick of it, the struggle with poverty and ugliness and meanness. And when the child is born, its peculiarly knitted brows and heavy eyes, which give the impression as if it is trying to understand something that is pain, move the mother's heart to pity. It pulls at her heart. She felt as if the navel string that had connected its frail little body with hers had not been broken. A wave of hot love went over to the infant. With all her force, with all her soul, she would make up to it for having brought it into the world unloved. Paul, in his childhood, is rather weak and delicate. Already he is prone to fits of depression. At times he cries without any specific reason, and when the mother has failed to reason him out of it or to amuse him, his father will threaten to beat him. It is this brutal atmosphere of that house that engenders a neurotic strain in Paul's personality. As Graham Hogg says, his neurotic refusal of life is direct result of his parents' failure. Factors shaping his temperament. Paul has been a highly sensitive child. It is rather tragic that such a sensitive child as Paul should be exposed to uncongenial atmosphere and acknowledging circumstances. Being a sickly child, Paul is exceptionally dependent on his mother. The brutal insensitive behavior of his father engenders a feeling of insecurity and fear in his tender heart. When the ash tree shrieks at night, it reminds him of the cries and howlings of his father. His heart in the grip of a terrible fear, Paul will lie awake in his bed, praying for the safety of his mother, guessing as to what his father will do next. And when the shrieking wind falls silent, Paul is overpowered by the horror of the sudden silence everywhere, outside and downstairs. His mind is assailed by unhappy thoughts. What was it? What is a silence of blood? What had he, Morel, done? And so he begins to hate his father. His nature is too refined to stand the uncouth and ugly manners of his father. His vulgarity is like a spiritual irritant to the soul of Paul. And Paul always avoids any contact with his father. When he wins a prize for the first time, he comes home running to tell his mother about it, but is very much reluctant to break the news to his father. And how much does Paul loathe his father when he, after the death of Mrs. Morel, indulges in false sentimentalizing. The uncongenial domestic atmosphere brings about three kinds of devastating effects upon the personality of Paul. First, he often calls into fits of depression. His mother tries to console him, but his father's callous attitude makes him feel all the more insecure. Graham Hogg rightly points out that Paul's neurotic refusal of life is the direct result of his parents' failure. Secondly, Paul develops an abiding hatred for his father, so much so that he begins to wish his father dead. And thirdly, this atmosphere is largely responsible for an unusual bond of interdependence between him and his mother. His self-consciousness. As Paul Morrell grows up, he becomes highly self-conscious. He is an introvert, a hypersensitive introvert to whom any touch with external reality is an agonizing experience. He suffers very much from the first contact with anything. When he first goes to the school, it is almost a nightmare for him. We also remember how much he suffers when he goes to collect the weekly wages of his father because the cashier and Mr. Winterbottom speaks to him in their characteristic vulgar way. He tells his mother of his resolve not to go there anymore because the people there are hateful and common. Mr. Braithwaite drops his and Mr. Winterbottom says, "You watch." The same intense was self-consciousness and a reluctance to face the realities of life were evident when his schooling being over, he is required to take up a job. And now writes Lawrence that he felt he had to go out into life. He went through agonies of sinking self-consciousness. His heart felt like a knot. Tight knot. He is full of apprehension when called for interview, and as he steps into the room of his employer, he feels himself martyred. Charles first mounted his scaffold with a lighter heart than had Paul Morrell as he followed his mother up the dirty steps to the dirty floor. His extreme nervousness renders him tongue-tied, and he can hardly read out the paper given him for the purpose. An artist at heart. Paul is an artist at heart. He loves to paint, and some of his paintings brings him prize in exhibitions. How happy is he when his landscapes get the first prize at Nottingham Castle Exhibition and is bought for 20 guineas. His paintings are also a manifestation of his lifelong quest of inner reality. His ideas on art are expressed feelings in his conversation with Miriam. He is explaining to her as to why one of his pictures is so true. It is because there is scarcely any show in it. It is more scenery, as if I had painted the scenery, protopause in the leaves and everywhere, and not the stiffness of the shape that seems dead to me. Only this shimmeriness is the real living. The shape is a dead crust. The shimmer is an inside reality. Painting gives him an inner satisfaction. When he is working at a sketch, he is isolated from outside world and loses himself in his pictures. It is intensity of his feelings for the shimmeriness of things that makes his sketches so intense and true. In his youth, Miriam inspires the artist in him, and with her he talks endlessly about his sketches, about his love of horizontals, the great levels of sky and of land in Lancashire suggests to him the internality of the will, while the Gothic arc symbolizes the ecstasy of the human soul in touch with the divine. One of the most touching scenes in the novel is the presentation of paint tubes to him by the girls working in the factory. They know how much Paul will appreciate their gift, and Paul really feels grateful to them. His intellectuality. Mrs. Morrell loves to be intellectual. Consequently, Paul Morrell has acquired from his mother a characteristic intellectualism. He has a love of things intellectual. He knows French and algebra and is glad to share his knowledge of these subjects with Miriam. Together they read and enjoy their favorite poems and authors. Lawrence's description of such scenes is not merely academic. It is a manifestation of his intense desire to live on a higher plane of being. His reserved soul seeks out in books that purity of experience which real life so often denies. His attachment to his mother. Mrs. Morrell is the single and most powerful influence upon Paul. Paul's early life, as also his development in youth, are conditioned by his mother's true love for him and his own compelling need for offer. From the beginning, both look to each other for love and life. Paul looks to her for comfort, for protection, and for sustaining love. Mrs. Morrell, unable to find fulfillment with her husband, turns to him for love and life. Paul's relationship with his mother is at first tranquil. They appear as companions, almost as lovers. They go out together to Nottingham for Paul's interview at Jordan's appliance factory. The two are seen in relief against the unfamiliar setting of Nottingham as they enjoy each other's company. She was gay, like a sweetheart, and he suffered because she would talk aloud in presence of the other travellers. They visit the Levers at Willey Farms during the Paul's convalescence. The two occasions vividly show the love between Paul and his mother. The intensity and importance of their relationship to each of them is clearly shown in Paul's love of painting at night as he sits alone with his mother. She sweet or dread. Then, looking up from his task, he would rest his eyes for a moment on her face that was bright with living warmth, and he returned gladly to his work. "I can do my best things when you sit there in your rocking chair, mother," he said. "I am sure," she exclaimed, sniffing with mock skepticism. But she felt it was so, and her heart quivered with brightness. For many hours she sat still, slightly conscious of him laboring away, and he, with all his soul's intensity directing his pencil, could feel her warmth inside him like strength. They were both very happy so, and both unconscious of it. When Miriam came into Paul's life, this new relationship interferes with the intimacy between Paul and his mother. Inevitably, there is strife as Mrs. Morrell sees Paul being drawn away from her, and we are told of her fears after Paul has spent an evening with Miriam, and it grew rather late. He knew his mother was fretting and getting angry about him. Mrs. Morrell does not care for Miriam. During the whole course of his relation with Miriam, Paul's emotions remain confused as he is torn between his deep love for his mother on the one hand and his growing involvement with Miriam on the other hand. And all the time Paul is drawn back to his mother. In fact, in all situations Paul realizes that he loves only his mother. Instinctively he realizes that he was life to her, and after all she was the chief thing to him. The only supreme thing. Mrs. Morrell's attachment to Paul is passive in nature. She does not realize the otherness of Paul, and her failure to achieve polarity in her relations with her son destroys him as a unified person. Paul is too strongly attached to his mother to achieve satisfactory relationship with other women. He fails with Miriam and he fails with Clara. By the end of the novel, it is clear that his mother has damaged his capacity for normal sexual relations. That he himself is aware of this is clear from what he says to his mother towards the end of the novel, "And I never shall meet the right woman while you live." Once Mrs. Novel disowns her husband and instead takes on first William and then Paul as husband substitutes, the split in the family and in the personalities of the sons is inevitable. Paul is a victim of the Oedipian situation. The life of his mother is so deeply rooted in him that she cannot suffer him to go to other women lest he should grow cold to her and get out of her range. She is always afraid of losing Paul to potential daughter-in-law, and this explains her hostility to Miriam, Paul's sweetheart. She resents Paul's going to her frequently and staying up with her till late in the evening. She accuses Miriam of possessiveness without ever caring to see that she may not ruin her son's life in doing so. Miriam is one of those who will want to have such a man's soul out till he had none of his own left, and he is just such a gaby as to let himself be absorbed. She never will let him become a man. She never will. And when she finds that Paul continues to befriend Miriam, she breaks down before him. "I can't bear it. I could let another woman, but not her. She had left me no room, not a bit of room." The tragedy of Paul's life is that neither the love of his mother nor the love of his sweetheart gives him that sense of freedom which is the essence of true relationship. And Paul knows all too well that he belongs to his mother, and that in hurting her he will merely be hurting a vital part of his own self. His world goes dark without her. In the end, he has no choice but to desert Miriam and to return to his mother. Lawrence described his mother's triumph this. Thus, he had come back to his mother. Here was the strongest tie in his life. When he thought round, Miriam shrank away. There was a vague unreal feel about her, and nobody else mattered. There was one place in the world that stood solid and did not melt into unreality. Unreality, the place where his mother was. His relations with Miriam. Paul meets Miriam for the first time on the Willey farm when Mrs. Morrell pays a visit to the Livia family. His relationship with Miriam is the most complex. Both are moving through the difficult period of adolescence, and Paul especially, although he is strongly attracted to Miriam, is often irritated by her to the point of hatred. But Miriam is highly impressed by Paul. From the beginning to the end, Paul-Miriam relationship is spiritual in nature. It's not physical attraction that brings them together, but their love of books and their desire to reach out for finer things of life. Both hate the common and the vulgar, and in both the inner life has been intensified to such a degree that commonplace things fall into insignificance and appear meaningless to them. Paul's company roses a warmth in Miriam. She, says Lawrence, seemed absorbed in him and by him when he was present, and is never more happy than when he is in company discussing his paintings or talking of things of the spirit of the mind. It sees in the other a restless urge to realize an instinctively richer life. Each uses the other as a means of exploring the possibilities of beckoning future in terms not so much of education and intellectual ambition, though that does largely too, as of emotional fulfillment. Each owes to the other their moments of supreme happiness as one reads through Lad and Girl Love. Chapter. One feels that Miriam lives for Paul and that Paul finds his meaning in Miriam. Miriam's religious intensity and purity of being cut her off from ordinary world and from contact with human beings, and therefore she turns to Paul for company and for love. She needs things to be kindled in her imagination before she can know them, and Paul's company does that. But Paul's friendship with Miriam is purely a matter of the soul. There is a spiritual love, some call it platonic, that exists on the plane of abstraction. Body does not enter in all their relations. Their intimacy, Lawrence tells us, goes on in a blanched and chaste fashion. Therefore, for all its intensity, Paul-Miriam relationship is inadequate. Sex is a reality that cannot be denied, and both in the latter stages of the novel become aware of the inadequacy of the relationship. Miriam overfinds sex and does not think physical relations essential to true love. She does not accept the whole being of Paul. The dilemma of Paul is that he cannot leave her because she holds the best part of him, and cannot stay with her because she does not take the rest of him. When we see Miriam for the last time with Paul at the end of the novel, she accepts defeat with heroic resignation and dignity. Each longs for the other, but neither can submit totally to the other. His relations with Clara. Paul meets Clara through Miriam, but is not immediately very impressed by her. While Miriam is spiritual in her outlook, Clara is all physical and sensual. She does not have the same depth of feeling as Miriam has. However, unable to find sexual satisfaction with Miriam, Paul is driven to Clara. Clara gives him a baptism in passion, but her love is inadequate too, for she cannot satisfy his soul. Their affair is too much on the surface to last long. She gives him all that Miriam cannot offer. But can a person so instinctively pure and moral as Paul is ever to be happy with a flippant girl like Clara? Her values are superficial, though the sexual experience that Paul had with her constitutes a deep and competitive consummation. Yet it fails to touch the inner man in him. How else can we account for Paul's abandonment of her, his reluctance to fight for her? He, in the end, gives her back to her husband and realizes that she cannot satisfy his total being. Conclusion. The Paul whom we see in the closing pages of the novel is a broken and disintegrated man. He has failed to achieve adequate relationship with all the three women who come in his life, his mother, Miriam, and Clara. And when Clara's husband Baxter does vanquish him, his defeat is complete. He is hurt and ill, not only physically but also spiritually. At the end of the novel, he is left a derelict with no one to guide his faltering steps, no one to stabilize him. He turns his back upon his village He uproots himself from his past life and walks towards the gold phosphorescence of the city. As he recedes into distance, the words of his mother ring in our minds: battle, battle, suffer. Now, the characteristics of Miriam. Introduction. Miriam is the heroine of the novel Sons and Lovers. When the novel was published in 1913, Jessie Chambers, the original of Miriam of the novel, was quick to express her indignation at Lawrence's portrayal of Paul's sweetheart. Obviously, she read Paul Miriam's affair in the light of her own friendship with the youthful Lawrence and felt that Lawrence had not faithfully represented the nature and quality of her desperate search for a right relationship. She might be perfectly justified in making this protest, but what she apparently did not realize was that Lawrence was not giving an account of his own life. He was writing a novel and was a novelist. He had full freedom to reinterpret the facts of real life in order to work out imaginatively his own vision of his life. Through Paul Miriam relationship, Lawrence was trying to explore the nature of true love. Their relationship fails. It fails because of its own inadequacy. Paul ignores the female in Miriam, and she ignores the male in him. Her physical appearance. When we first meet Miriam, she is about 14 years old. She was a rosy, dark face, a bunch of short black curls and brown eyes. When she is 16, she is described as very beautiful, with her warm coloring, her gravity, her eyes dilating suddenly like an ecstasy. On the whole, Miriam has been represented as a blooming woman of attractive physical charm, but the novelist's purpose is not to describe the physical beauty of Miriam, but her psyche. Her introvert nature. Miriam is an introvert by nature. The insensitive and brutal behavior of her brothers has made her reluctant to enter into relationship with the outside world in general, and men folk in particular. The grossness of her father is no less repelling to her. Her brothers are highly unrefined. She is quite hopeless against the bullying tactics of her brothers. Brothers, often slighted and belittled. Miriam has no alternative but to shun all contacts with the outside world and to withdraw within herself. Her religious intensity also contributes considerably to her separation from ordinary life. Her fierce sense of identity. Miriam has a fierce sense of identity. She hates her brother because they deny her personality. She is always afraid of being set at naught by others. This sense of identity is strengthened by her native pride. She wants to be considered to distinguish herself, and therefore she is married to have learning wear on to pride herself. She does not set much store by physical beauty, and to princess she cannot be by wealth or standing. Therefore, with all ardor and enthusiasm, she devotes herself to acquire knowledge. If she can read French and English classics, the world would have a different face for her and a deepened respect. Her desire for learning. Miriam hates her position as an ordinary swine girl. Not that she wants to acquire knowledge to satisfy her vanity, but she is genuinely interested in expanding her intellectual horizons, in knowing the best that has been thought and written. She puts her heart and soul in her French and algebra lessons. Her brothers unwittingly pay her a tribute when they say she never dares to do anything except recite poetry. Though generally averse to mankind, yet if she begins to love Paul, it is because of his love of books. She never tries of reading poems and discussing his paintings with Paul. When Paul's mother scoffs at his friendship with Miriam, Paul is quick to point out that Miriam provides him what she herself cannot, intellectual company. And even when Paul has broken off with her, he does not fail to acknowledge that her criticism of his paintings have always been grand appreciations. His sobriety and contemplative spirit. Miriam is over-refined, mystical and sober. From her mother, she has inherited a love of religion, and her soul experiences a state of religious ecstasy when she beholds God's wonder in the flaming western skies or in the burning rose bush. A meditative sadness invests her with a grave dignity. Seldom do we hear her laughing whole-heartedly and uninhibitedly. Paul notices that she is always sad, and even her joy is like a flame coming off sadness. She, in the words of Paul, is not like an ordinary tree with fidgety leaves and jolly, but like a pine tree. And her religiosity culminates in an over-refined love of abstract purity and a sensitiveness that recoils from the slightest touch without mention of the physical matters pertaining to the form or never discussed in presence. She quivers in agonies from the vulgarity of the other choir girls and from the common sounding voice of the curate, a source of artistic inspiration to Paul. Miriam brings out the artist in Paul in life. Her presence has fertilizing influence on Paul. She brings forth his imagination for him, and her presence stimulates Paul into creative activity. It is worthwhile to quote her the following sentences from the novel. In contact with Miriam, he gained insight. His vision went deeper. From his mother, he drew the life warmth, the strength to produce. Miriam urged his warmth into intensity like a white light. And it is precisely for this reason that Paul's breaking of her is so tragic. In separating himself from her, he is cutting himself off from the source of his life, his inspiration. And it must have been intensely tragic for her love. Her love for Paul. Miriam's love for Paul is all spiritual and abstract. Their friendship has been described as a blanched and chaste. It is all a matter of spirit. The body just doesn't enter in it. Even the slightest awareness of the need of physical passion causes uneasiness both to Miriam and Paul. In chapter 7, Miriam is troubled when they both are looking at the beautiful moon, and she becomes dimly aware of Paul's passion. He did not know himself. What was the matter? He was naturally so young, and their intimacy was so abstract, he did not know. He wanted to crush her onto his breast to ease the ache there. He was afraid to offer. The fact that he might want her as a man wants a woman had in him been suppressed into a shame. When she shrank in her convulsed, coiled torture from the thought of such a thing, he had winced to the depth of his soul, and now this purity prevented even their first love kiss. It was as if she could scarcely stand the shock of physical love, even a passionate kiss, and then he was too shrinking and sensitive to give it. She knows the artist in Paul, but not the male in him. It is worthwhile to quote here the comment of the novelist. It seemed as if he, virginity were a positive force which fought and won in both of them. Towards the close of the novel, Paul, as he looks back at his past, friendship with Miriam rightly annihilates the cause of the failure of their relationship. Don't you think we have been too fierce in our what they call purity? Don't you think that to be so much afraid and averse is a sort of dirtiness? Such a fierceness in purity, as a critic has put it, reminds one of the young Milton. But nevertheless, her love is thoughtful and sound so deep. In him, she finds a creature who is quite light and graceful, and who loves ideas. She is full of admiration for his paintings, and her intimacy creeps into incandescence. His desire to reach out for higher and finer things of life. For removed from the physical, their friendship is based essentially on their concern for the essence of life and things. And when Paul agrees to give him Miriam lessons in algebra and French, she feels grateful to him, for he is perhaps the first man to give her due recognition. Little wonder, therefore, that she attaches so much value to his friendship. It is the most prized thing in her life. The depth of her love for Paul can be gauged from the fact that his welfare is the uppermost thing in her thoughts. All her prayers are for him, and all that she desires is to help him on in life, to be the mistress of him in his weakness, to take care of him if he could depend on her. Lauren says she always seemed absorbed in him and by him when he was present, and in his turn, Paul respects her friendship and does not hesitate to lay bare his soul before her. As he talks to her of his hopes and aspirations, his struggles and difficulties, Miriam feels as if she is watching that very quivering stuff of life in him, and she resolves to herself that she will jealously guard the best in Paul which he has never given her. Nay, this guy did not cherish the stars more purely and eternally than she would guard the good in the soul of Paul Morel. She went on home alone, feeling exalted in her faith. Mrs. Morel's dislike of Miriam. Miriam is not liked by Mrs. Morel, and when she becomes rival of Mrs. Morel, it is Miriam's depth of love for Paul that excites Mrs. Morel's jealousy. Had she been contented with mere physical relationship with Paul, Mrs. Morel might have tolerated her, but she hungers for the soul of Paul, for relationship in which there is complete union and identification of the two souls. Mrs. Morel accuses her of monopolizing Paul, of alienating her own son from her. She exults. Nay, the sky did not cherish the stars more surely and internally than she would guard the good in the soul of Paul Morel. She went on home alone, feeling exalted in her faith. Mrs. Morel's dislike of Miriam. Miriam is not liked by Mrs. Morel. In a way, she becomes a rival of Mrs. Morel. It is Miriam's depth of love for Paul that excites Mrs. Morel's jealousy. Had she been contented with mere physical relationship with Paul, Mrs. Morel might have tolerated her, but she hungers for the soul of Paul, for a relationship in which there is complete union and identification of the two souls. Mrs. Morel accuses her of monopolizing Paul, of alienating her own son from her. She exults as she carries him off from me. She is not like an ordinary human who can leave him me, my share in him. She wants to absorb him. She wants to draw him out and absorb him till there is nothing left of him, even for himself. The active hostility of Mrs. Morel precipitates a crisis in Paul's relations with Miriam. Miriam is the necessity of his being, and yet he cannot continue his intimacy with her, for it hurts his mother who counts so much for him, and Miriam has no choice but to reconcile herself to her bitter fate, her failure in her relationship with Paul. Miriam is always obsessed with the idea that she is not worthy of Paul's love. She feels that she cannot give all that Paul desires. Therefore, she is always torn between her irresistible desire for Paul's friendship and her distrust of her own feelings. It is clear that Paul and Miriam, because of their very different personalities, are bound to clash in some way in despite of their attraction for each other. And so one day in March, as they are on the bank of Nathemreyer, Paul could not bear to look at Miriam. She seemed to want him, and she resisted. She resisted all the time. He wanted now to give her passion and tenderness, and he could not. He felt that she wanted the soul out of his body and not him. All his strength and energy she drew into herself through some channel which united them. She did not want to meet him, so that there were two of them, man and woman together. She wanted to draw all of him into her. These incidents show the two lovers. Conflicting emotions as they struggle with each other. Each loves the other, and yet Paul is also repelled almost to the point of hating Miriam. They long for each other and yet are inhibited. Paul is tormented by his developing sexuality, and Miriam longs to establish a spiritual rather than a physical union between them. Miriam exists on a plane of abstraction where anything physical is loathsome. Her intimacy with Paul is absolutely spiritual. Even a kiss is not possible between them. To quote from the novel, if she could have kissed her in abstract purity, he would have done so. But she could not kiss her there, and she seemed to have no other way. She cares only for the artist in him, but does not see the male in him. And as Paul grows up, he increasingly feels the necessity of having physical relations with women. His desires unappeared and turbulent torment him. There's hardly anything more moving in the novel than the scenes in which Paul fights against his own desires. And when he realizes the inadequacy of his relations with Miriam, he decides to break off with her, or he cannot love her as a man would love a woman. He writes her a letter, bitterly cruel, accusing her of being a nun. The truth is that both Miriam and Paul are unable to accept passion or as essential to man-woman relationship. Their love of purity is fierce and destroys all possibilities of their ever achieving a balanced relationship. Another reason of her failure with Paul is the streak of possessiveness in Miriam's temperament. She wants to possess and guard the soul of Paul. Some critics go to the extent of saying that she does not allow Paul to keep his own identity intact. She wants to possess the thing she loves. Paul rages at her attitude towards flowers. She whittles the soul out of things. Exasperated by her behavior, Paul asks her, "Can you never like things without clutching them as if you wanted to pull hurt out of them?" Here, Lawrence is trying to explore as to what should be the true relationship between man and woman. True love, according to him, is based on the recognition of the essential otherness of other. One should not only respect the identity and personality of the other, but also allow it to flower out. Miriam Paul friendship ends in the failure because they fail to achieve a well-balanced relationship. Now, the characteristics of Clara Dawes. Introduction. Clara Dawes is the daughter of an old friend of Mrs. Leavers. She plays a short but important role in the novel. Clara's husband, Baxter Dawes, is a smith employed at Jordan's, but she is separated from her husband and stays with her mother. Emphasizing her importance in the story, H.T. Moore makes the following observation. Clara's blonde Junesque beauty brings an element into the story that is needed for this ripe woman is an effective foil for both the aging mother and the dreaming young girl. Because the relationship with Clara is primarily and almost exclusively physical, there is plenty of dramatic contrast. And the fact that both the mother and Miriam want to possess Paul spiritually subtilizes and enriches the entire situation. Clara has been painted as a foil to Miriam. While Miriam is sexually inhibited, Clara is sexually aggressive. This enables Florence to explore the various aspects of sex relationships. It is in these two characters that Florence emphasizes the importance of both, the souls and body, in the attainment of sexual harmony. Her physical appearance. Clara is a woman with physical appeal. She brings an element of sensuality in the story. Her skin is white like honey and she has a full mouth and attractive appearance. Consider, for instance, the passages when Paul dwells on her physical charm. She looked beautiful. Her costume of dark cloth fitted so beautifully over her breast and shoulder. Her hair was done fashionably. The dress, a simple thing of green crepe, suited her. She looked grand. The firmness and the softness of her upright body could almost be felt as he looked at her. He clenched his fists at this sentence. Her beauty was a torture to him. Independent and emancipated. Clara is a self-respecting and independent woman. She boldly faces the cruel strokes of fate. She has left her husband because he bullied her and treated her brutally. She now lives with her mother and earns her livelihood by working in a factory or by fruitfully utilizing her time at home. Her feelings being scared by the insensitive behavior of her husband, she now believes in and identifies herself with the suffragette movement. Women must be as free and independent as men are. This is her cry. When Paul asks her if she is happy after her separation from her husband, she retorts in her characteristic manner, "So long as I can be free and independent." Passionate and sensuous. Miriam is spiritual, Clara is passionate, Clara is frankly physical. Miriam wants a committed love and that's why her relationship with Paul ends in failure. But Clara makes no demands on Paul. To Paul, she appears provocative because of the knowledge on Paul. To Paul, she appears provocative because of the knowledge she seems to possess. She knows that Paul needs patience, and she offers him that immensity of patience which Miriam could not. And when Texarcy is not a beloved who wants to possess his soul, but only a woman, Paul's sexual experience with her constitutes a deep and complete consummation. The whole universe is involved in their lovemaking, and he knows for the first time the blind force of life. Her relations with Paul. Clara's relations with Paul are only on the physical plane. Paul and Clara affair is seen largely from Paul's point of view. But it is not worked out in nearly the same inner detail as his affair with Miriam. This relationship dwells on little else besides physical attraction. Although Paul does fall in love with Clara, we gain the impression that he is searching for the sexual fulfillment that he could not achieve with Miriam. We are constantly made aware of Clara's physical attraction for Paul. Both achieve a passionate and spontaneous union, such that Paul was unable to achieve with Miriam. But in spite of their physical adventures, Clara is dissatisfied. They had known, but she could not keep the moment. She wanted it again. She wanted something permanent. She had not got him. She was not satisfied. She had been there, but she had not gripped the something, she knew not what, which she was mad to have. Though Clara may satisfy Paul's importunate physical desires, but she cannot satisfy his soul. She is too physical ever to hold a person so intrinsically spiritual and moral as Paul is. This may be the reason why Paul, even after having sexual relations with her, never feels for her the tenderness which a man normally feels for the woman he loves. She is not the sort of woman so can keep his soul steady. Paul wants her to be something she cannot be. Clearly, such a relationship cannot last long, and in the end, he hands her back to her husband. Her reunion with Baxter. Clara's reunion with her husband Baxter is the result of her lack of confidence in Paul. Slowly and slowly, she begins to feel a certain surety about Baxter, her estranged husband, that she never felt with Paul. Therefore, though she is hurt being cast off by Paul finally, she goes back to her husband gracefully without losing her composure. Life has taught her how best to reconcile herself to her fate. Clara now realized that her husband had loved her 1,000 times more than Paul. Therefore, we are told that at the bottom of her heart, she always wanted to go back to her husband. Paul becomes instrumental in bringing Clara and Baxter together, and then disappears from Paul's life.